Picture this. A community feels like their health and their homes have been poisoned by a major corporation's toxic waste. The question that immediately jumps out is, how do they even begin to prove that in a courtroom?
Yeah, that's a huge hurdle.
Today, we're diving deep into Raipoli Railroad Yard PCB litigation. It's a landmark case that really reshaped how expert evidence is evaluated in environmental lawsuits, especially when we're talking about proving what caused the harm and, you know, who should be held responsible.
Right. This case brought together residents and workers near a Pennsylvania rail yard who sued rail operators and PCB manufacturers, claiming, well, widespread contamination.
And what's fascinating right from the start is this fundamental challenge of proving cause and effect, isn't it?
Yeah.
Especially with something like environmental contamination.
Absolutely. Could the plaintiffs scientifically demonstrate that their PCB exposure was the reason for their health issues and the decline in their property values? And crucially, how would the courts decide which scientific evidence was reliable enough to even consider?
It's exactly.
Yeah.
The Third Circuit Court of Appeals found itself right in the middle of this, having to review the district court's decisions on excluding a lot of that expert testimony. It was quite the back and forth.
It really was. And, you know, to understand the stakes, you need to know a bit about what we're dealing with. PCBs, those polychlorinated biphenyls.
Nasty stuff.
Definitely. They were used in the electrical transformers at the Pauley Rail Yard starting way back in the 1950s. And, well, over time, these substances leaked into the soil, the groundwater, okay, potentially affecting the surrounding residential areas.
So the people living and working there brought a whole range of claims. Personal injury due to health problems, they linked to the PCBs. They also claimed property damage. And this is where it gets interesting, because it included stigma.
Ah, yes. The stigma damages.
The idea that property values drop simply because of the fear of contamination, even without direct physical harm.
Which is a really tough concept legally.
And finally, they sought medical monitoring under CERCLE, that's the Superfund law, basically asking the defendants to pay for long-term health checkups to catch any potential illnesses that might develop later on.
Yeah, if you connect this to the bigger picture, you see this classic David and Goliath scenario playing out. But with this heavy reliance on complex scientific evidence, the residents are saying, we've been wronged, and they need credible scientific backing to make their case.
But the district court, initially at least, was quite skeptical of some of their expert evidence, wasn't it?
Very skeptical.
Yeah.
Which led to those two significant appeals to the Third Circuit. It really highlights this crucial gatekeeping role that courts play in deciding what kind of scientific information is admissible in legal proceedings.
Okay, so let's unpack this procedural history a little bit. The first big appeal was Pauley v. First in 1990. The district court had initially thrown out a lot of the plaintiff's expert testimony. But the Third Circuit came in and reversed that. What was the core reason for that initial reversal? What did the Third Circuit see?
Well, what's important to grasp about Pauley's assert is that the Third Circuit's decision wasn't necessarily about saying the plaintiff's experts were definitely right, you know?
Right.
Instead, they found that the process the district court used to exclude that testimony had some legal flaws. It wasn't so much a judgment on the scientific validity of the opinions at that stage, but more about whether the lower court had followed the correct legal procedures for evaluating and potentially excluding scientific evidence.
So kind of a procedural foul almost.
Exactly. It was, as you said, a bit of a reset button, making sure the process was fair before even getting too deep into the science itself.
Okay, that makes sense. So fast forward then to 1994 and Pauley II. The district court took another look, presumably trying to follow the right procedures this time, and again granted summary judgment for the defendants on many of the claims. Essentially, they were saying, even with this expert testimony, there's still not enough proof for the plaintiffs to win.
Right. They weren't convinced.
And this, naturally, led to another appeal to the Third Circuit, this time resulting in a partial reversal. So by the time the case got back to the Third Circuit for the second time, what were the really key legal questions they were wrestling with? Things had evolved a bit.
Yeah, things had definitely crystallized. This raises some fundamental questions about how our legal system deals with complex scientific issues. First and foremost was the issue of causation. Could the plaintiffs present enough reliable scientific evidence to demonstrate that their specific health problems were actually caused by the PCB exposure from the rail yard?
The million-dollar question, really.
Always. Second, there was that somewhat novel and complex issue of property stigma. Mm-hmm. Could the decrease in property values due to the perceived risk of contamination be considered legally compensable damages, even if there was no direct physical damage to the properties themselves?
Still a tough one.
Very. Third, the significant question of medical monitoring. Under what legal criteria is it appropriate to require the defendants to pay for long-term health monitoring for individuals who might develop illnesses in the future because of the exposure?
Which has huge implications for public health and corporate responsibility.
Absolutely. And underpinning all of these questions was the big one. How do courts properly apply and interpret the Supreme Court's Daubert standard when deciding if expert testimony is reliable enough to be presented to a jury? That was really looming large by Paley II.
Let's really focus on that Daubert standard because it's so pivotal, isn't it? Not just for this case, but for so many legal battles involving science. For our listeners who might be, you know, encountering this for the first time, can you break down what the Daubert standard is and what the key factors are that courts consider?
Sure. What's truly significant about Daubert, which came out of a Supreme Court decision, is that it fundamentally changed how federal courts assess scientific evidence. Before Daubert, the main test was the Frye standard.
Right, the general acceptance test.
Exactly. Frye essentially looked at whether a scientific technique was generally accepted in the relevant scientific field. Daubert broadened this significantly and introduced a more flexible, multi-factor analysis.
So what are those factors?
Well, these factors include whether the expert's theory or technique can be tested. Is it falsifiable? Has it been subjected to peer review and publication in reputable scientific journals? What is the known or potential rate of error associated with the scientific technique? Are there established standards controlling the technique's operation?
Okay.
And while general acceptance in the scientific community is still a relevant factor, it's no longer the only deciding point, which was a big shift.
And there's the fit requirement too, right?
Crucially, yes. Daubert also introduced the concept of fit, meaning the expert's testimony must be relevant to the specific facts of the case and actually help the jury understand the evidence or determine a key fact in dispute. It can't just be interesting science. It has to fit the legal questions.
And this framework is also reflected in Federal Rule of Evidence 702.
Precisely. Rule 702 outlines the necessary qualifications of an expert, the reliability of their methods, and the sufficiency of the facts they rely on for their testimony to be admissible. Daubert essentially provides the framework for interpreting Rule 702's reliability requirement.
Got it. And this is where the Third Circuit really took issue with the district court's handling of things in Pella II, correct? It wasn't necessarily about whether the Third Circuit agreed with the plaintiff's expert's conclusions.
No, not at all.
But more about the way the district court was evaluating their reliability. Can you elaborate on that distinction? Because it seems subtle, but really important.
It is subtle, but critical. The Third Circuit felt that the district court had basically overstepped its role as the gatekeeper. It appeared the lower court was dismissing the experts because it simply disagreed with their ultimate opinions on causation, rather than focusing squarely on whether the methods the experts used to reach those opinions were scientifically sound and reliable.
So judging the destination instead of the journey, so to speak.
Kind of, yeah. The Third Circuit emphasized that under Daubert, the judge's responsibility is to ensure the reliability of the underlying methodology and principles of the testimony. It's not to act as a super fact finder and decide whether the expert's opinion is ultimately correct. That's the jury's job, provided the foundation, the methodology, of the expert's testimony is reliable.
Okay. You brought up the example of differential diagnosis earlier. This was apparently a key point in the case, and it might be a new concept for some of our listeners. Could you explain what differential diagnosis is and why it became such a point of contention in the Pauli litigation?
Sure. What's particularly interesting here is how a pretty common medical practice ended up being so central to this legal battle. Differential diagnosis is essentially the process that doctors use routinely to identify a patient's illness. They do it by systematically ruling out other possible causes until they arrive at the most likely diagnosis.
Like a process of elimination.
Exactly, a process of elimination in medicine. In the Pauli case, some of the plaintiff's experts used differential diagnosis to argue that PCB exposure was the most probable cause of the plaintiff's illnesses. They did this by considering their symptoms, medical histories, exposure levels, and then excluding other potential causes.
And the defendants pushed back on that.
Oh, absolutely. The defendants challenged this, arguing that it wasn't a sufficiently reliable scientific method for establishing legal causation in a toxic tort case. They argued it was too subjective or speculative.
But the Third Circuit saw it differently.
They did. The Third Circuit recognized that while differential diagnosis isn't, you know, a perfect science, it often deals in probabilities, it is a generally accepted and reliable method within the medical field for determining the cause of an individual patient's condition. The crucial point for the Third Circuit was that the experts had to have properly performed this process, meaning they had to thoroughly consider and convincingly rule out other plausible causes based on each individual's specific circumstances. The court drew a really clear distinction between the reliability of the method itself, differential diagnosis as a concept, and whether a specific expert had correctly applied that method in a particular case.
Ah, okay. So messing up the application doesn't automatically kill the whole method's reliability.
Right. Flaws in the application might affect the weight a jury gives to the evidence, you know, how convincing it is, but it doesn't necessarily make the testimony inadmissible under Dauber as long as the underlying method itself is deemed reliable.
That's a really important distinction for litigators to understand. So with this understanding of Dauber and the Third Circuit's perspective on expert reliability, how did it ultimately impact the different types of claims the plaintiffs brought? Let's look at personal injury, medical monitoring, and property stigma claims individually.
Okay. If we look at the outcomes through the lens of Dauber, we see a sort of mixed bag, a nuanced result. For the personal injury claims, the Third Circuit ultimately upheld the summary judgment in favor of the defendants.
So the plaintiffs lost on those?
On the personal injury claims, yes. While the Third Circuit agreed that the district court had initially been too restrictive in excluding some expert testimony back in Pally for Fourth, they concluded that, at the end of the day, even considering that evidence, the plaintiffs still hadn't presented enough reliable evidence to directly and specifically link their individual illnesses to the PCB exposure from the rail yard.
So failure on specific causation.
Exactly. The court felt there was a lack of sufficient proof of what's called specific causation for each person's health issues. General causation, can PCBs cause this type of illness? Might be met, but specific causation, did this exposure cause this plaintiff's illness, was lacking.
That makes sense. Proving that a specific chemical exposure caused a particular illness in one individual can be incredibly challenging, scientifically speaking. What about the medical monitoring claims? What was the outcome there?
Ah, now this is where the Third Circuit's decision was more favorable to the plaintiffs. They determined that the expert testimony concerning the increased risk of future harm due to PCB exposure, and therefore the necessity for long-term medical monitoring, did meet the Dauber standard for reliability.
So that evidence was considered solid enough?
Yes. The experts had presented risk assessments, analyses of potential future health problems based on the exposure levels that the Third Circuit considered sufficiently scientifically sound. Consequently, the court reversed the summary judgment on these medical monitoring claims and sent them back to the district court for further proceedings, potentially a trial.
That's a significant win for the plaintiffs then.
It really was. It established that under specific conditions, if you have robust expert evidence demonstrating a significant exposure and a clearly heightened risk of future illness, defendants could be legally obligated to fund medical surveillance. That's a big deal.
Definitely. And finally, what was the decision regarding the claims for property stigma? Were the homeowners successful in arguing that their property values had declined simply due to the public perception of contamination?
On this one, the Third Circuit agreed with the district court and rejected these claims. The primary reasoning was rooted in Pennsylvania state law.
Not federal law or Dauber.
Primarily state law here. Pennsylvania law generally requires proof of actual permanent physical damage to property to recover for diminution in value. The court found that the plaintiffs hadn't adequately demonstrated permanent physical damage, especially considering the EPA's ongoing cleanup efforts at the site.
So the cleanup efforts actually worked against the stigma claim in a way.
Arguably, yes. The court's reasoning suggested that if the government was actively remediating the contamination, the harm wasn't necessarily permanent in the legal sense required by Pennsylvania law. So, despite the very real possibility or even likelihood of reduced property values due to public perception, the specific legal requirement of permanent physical damage wasn't met.
It's really interesting to see how the court applied these evidentiary rules and state law doctrines differently to each distinct type of claim, leading to quite different outcomes.
Absolutely. It shows how important the specific type of claim and the relevant underlying law are alongside the evidentiary standards like Dauber.
Now, within the Third Circuit's ruling in Pally II, there was also a concurring opinion from Judge Roth. What were his key points, and why is his separate opinion significant? He agreed with the outcome but had something extra to say.
Exactly. Judge Roth's concurring opinion really highlights a crucial, practical point about the application of Daubert. While he agreed with the majority's overall conclusions in the case, the specific results for each claim type, he raised an important cautionary note.
What was his concern?
His concern was that even methodologies that technically satisfy the Daubert criteria for reliability, they pass the testability, peer review factors, etc., could still potentially confuse or mislead juries if the evidence they produce is just too complex or doesn't clearly relate to the specific legal question that the jury needs to decide.
So even if an expert uses a scientifically valid method, the results might still be too opaque, too dense, or maybe even too speculative for a jury of non-scientists to properly understand and apply to the legal issues in the case.
Precisely. Judge Roth argued that the judge, in their role as the gatekeeper under Daubert and Rule 702, should also consider Rule 403 of the Federal Rules of Evidence. That rule allows judges to exclude relevant evidence if its probative value is substantially outweighed by the danger of unfair prejudice, confusing the issues, misleading the jury, or wasting time.
Bringing Rule 403 into the Daubert analysis.
Yes. He argued that judges should have the discretion to exclude evidence that, while technically admissible under Daubert's reliability test, is so confusing or potentially misleading that it could prevent the jury from reaching a fair and accurate verdict.
That really highlights a tension, doesn't it?
It really does. He emphasized the inherent tension between the judge's duty to ensure the reliability of evidence coming in and the jury's fundamental role as the ultimate finder of fact. It touches upon these ongoing debates about the appropriate level of judicial discretion. How much should the judge control what the jury hears, especially with really complex science?
So looking at the broader implications, what is the lasting significance of Indra Pally Railroad Yard PCB litigation? What are the key takeaways, especially for our aspiring lawyers who are listening?
Well, what's truly significant about Pally, particularly within the Third Circuit, but influential beyond, is how it solidified and clarified the judge's role as a gatekeeper of scientific evidence under the Daubert standard. It strongly reinforced the principle that judges must rigorously examine the reliability of the methods employed by expert witnesses.
But not judge the conclusion itself.
Exactly. It simultaneously cautioned against judges overstepping and making judgments on the ultimate correctness of the scientific conclusions themselves. That determination is generally reserved for the jury, assuming, again, that the underlying scientific foundation is sound.
And for plaintiffs in these cases.
The case also powerfully illustrates the very real and significant hurdles that plaintiffs face in toxic tort cases. Trying to definitively prove that their specific injuries were directly caused by exposure to a particular substance is incredibly difficult. It underscores that they absolutely need to present strong, credible expert witnesses who can clearly articulate that causal link using scientifically accepted methodologies.
That's a really crucial insight for our listeners. So if you're a law student, maybe thinking about environmental law or really any area that heavily involves expert testimony, what are some concrete, practical things you should take away from the Pally case?
Okay, let's translate this into practical advice. If you're involved in drafting expert reports or preparing expert witnesses for deposition or trial, you absolutely cannot just focus on the expert's final opinion, their conclusion. You need to meticulously detail the methodology they used.
Show your work, essentially.
Absolutely. Show the work. Detail the underlying scientific basis for their analysis. Don't just state, the PCBs caused the illness, explain how the expert arrived at that conclusion. What specific tests or data did they rely upon? What alternative explanations did they consider and rule out? Why is their chosen method considered reliable within the relevant scientific community? Spell it all out.
And what about those medical monitoring claims?
Right. Paoli demonstrates that medical monitoring claims can be a viable path to relief, maybe even more so than direct personal injury claims sometimes. But, and this is key, they demand robust expert evidence specifically demonstrating a significant level of exposure and a clearly elevated risk of developing future harm. The risk analysis has to be solid.
And the Daubert distinction.
Finally, always, always keep in mind that critical distinction between the reliability of an expert's method and the correctness of their opinion when you're either challenging or defending expert testimony under Daubert. Just because you disagree with an expert's conclusion doesn't automatically mean their testimony is inadmissible if the underlying scientific methods they used are sound and properly applied. Focus on the methodology.
That's incredibly valuable guidance. So, as we conclude this deep dive into in Repaley Railroad Yard PCB litigation, here's maybe a final thought for you to consider. Given the intricate relationship between complex scientific evidence and legal standards that this case so vividly illustrates, how do you believe courts can most effectively strike that delicate balance? That balance between protecting public health on one hand and ensuring fair and just litigation processes in cases involving environmental contamination on the other?
That's a huge question.
It is. It's a question that continues to shape our legal landscape, and Paoli is a really key piece of that ongoing conversation.
Definitely. And if you're interested in exploring this further, we strongly encourage you to delve into the specifics of the Daubert standard itself, maybe take a closer look at Rule 702 of the Federal Rules of Evidence, and really examine the complexities of proving causation in toxic tort litigation.
Yeah, there's a lot more depth there.
Oh, yeah. You might also find it beneficial to research other significant cases that have grappled with similar issues of environmental contamination and the admissibility of expert testimony. Paoli is important, but it's part of a larger body of law.